Thanks for listening to Echolocation Storm Surge Sounding, our fall 2018 broadcast. And stay tuned for hour two, when we'll be exploring the sounds of some cold weather phenomena and, of course, of the wind.
This is John Hall. You're listening to WGXC 90.7 Acre.
Welcome to WGXC's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane. On today's show, I'm joined by Matthew Frederick, author of 101 Things I Learned in Design School, resident of Hudson, to discuss the Hudson Housing Authority's plan to add over 70 units of affordable and senior housing to State Street in Hudson, a project that has the potential to dramatically alter the streetscape and character of the Second Ward. Following that, we have a chat with Carolyn Riggs, local political strategist and current head of the Hunter Democratic Committee, for a discussion on building out a Democratic base in traditionally conservative rural communities and laying out a progressive agenda in Greene County. You're listening to WGXC. This is At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane, joined by Matthew Frederick, a Hudson resident, architect, urban designer, and the author of 9 titles in the best-selling 101 Things I Learned book series. Matthew, welcome.
Thank you, John.
So on the subject of housing development, Hudson has a couple of large housing projects in the works. One of those is the Kasry development, which I think a lot of people are aware of, and that is a waterfront development of nebulous scope and proportion, closer to the waterfront and the Amtrak station. When Hudson received a DRI grant, the Hudson Development Corporation got $487,000 to raise that site. There is another development, also part of the DRI, on State Street, across the street from Bliss Towers, and that is $800,000. It was supposed to be for mixed use and mixed income housing on State Street.
Yes, that's what I understand. Are there any others going on right now?
I don't believe there are any others that I'm aware of. Are you aware of?
No, I don't think so, but they tend to come out of the woodwork.
Yes, as a matter of fact, the State Street development seems to have Hudson Housing Authority opened up a design charrette a few months ago, which you attended. And generally, it's a very long process between the start of these discussions and groundbreaking. Unlike the CAS, which has stalled, as these housing projects do right now, while HDC rethinks its strategy, this project already has a developer assigned to it, and that's PRC out of New York City. You attended the design charrette for the HHA project on State Street. What were your thoughts on that?
We had probably 30 or more folks from the community and from Bliss Tower show up. And so there was a very good turnout, but I think to a person we were really surprised that we were right in the middle of, we weren't even in the middle of the design of a building. We were shown the a designed building. Everything was drawn on these floor plans, every toilet, every kitchen sink. And we were told, oh, you know, suggest anything you can. But I think right then we all got the sense that this thing is going where it's going, and we don't have a lot of opportunity here to shape it as Hudson needs it shaped.
And generally, there is more community input earlier in the process.
Getting something built is difficult, and you kind of need to start way out broad, much broader than the scope of what you're trying to do. And I'm gesturing here with my hands, trying to indicate that if your site is a given size, you want to go several blocks beyond that, or even citywide, to understand how what you're building fits into the rest of the city. And that's not just a physical design problem, that's a people issue too. So you've got to engage the community very broadly before you put a pen to paper, and only gradually let the project acquire a shape.
As part of the DRI, $800,000 was allotted to the site for retail and community space on the first floor, and approximately 40 units of housing for incomes between 30% to 120% of AMI. This project is considerably larger than that.
We went to, what, 73 or 76? I hear both of those.
It seems to change, but yeah, certainly in that range.
So what is it 40 units of senior housing and 30-something of
that seems to be a moving target as well. But yeah, I mean, certainly there was a strategic housing action plan done as part of the DRI that indicated a need for more senior housing because we do have an aging population. It also indicated that we needed more affordable housing. I mean, that was an obvious takeaway. I think anybody could have told you they would have come up with that. But it did indicate that that affordable housing should be spread throughout the city. It shouldn't be just locked into a single area.
Well, you'll remember that, I think, I don't know if you were in Hudson at the time, but probably 6 years ago, HHA floated a proposal to disperse housing across the city and I believe take down Bliss Tower. There's a real problem when one organization, a public authority, is charged with maintaining 30-some projects around the city. They're just never going to be able to do it, and that was the most foolish thing about that. However, if you have Section 8 housing, and it's private sector housing for which there's Section 8 subsidy to the tenants, that works very differently. So from a management standpoint, if I'm HHA, I want the housing right there. From an urban and community perspective, what does it mean to put all of the lower income, or so many of the lower income residents of the city in one corner in the second ward?
What does that mean?
It means that becomes a place that I don't know if it has a way forward. At least social theory tends to say that if you're on the lower end of the socioeconomic spectrum, if you're around other folks, there's opportunity for engagement, for employment, for a sense of belonging, and it works better for everybody. We're in a weird situation with public housing where I'm suspecting that it may go away in 15 years, that we will no longer have public housing authorities administering authority-owned buildings, that we may be going to strictly a Section 8 private sector kind of arrangement.
Now, is that necessarily bad?
It's not. It's only bad if we're not planning for it, I guess. Imagine now, so the way this project here in Hudson is to work is that HHA partners with PRC, the private developer, for at least 15 years. At that 15-year mark, HHA can buy their way out of that agreement. And at that point, they own the buildings again. So what do they do? And what if public housing authorities go away? What happens to that housing at that point? What I'd like to see is for us to develop a strategy so that That area of the second ward, and in particular I'm thinking of State Street down to the river, but also some of the other undeveloped blocks in that area that are more suburban than urban, that they could be developed in at a more urban appropriate intensity and could become a mixed income neighborhood if we're planning for it. So if we get to the 15-year mark and HHA has the opportunity to buy these units, the housing units, back from the private developer, is there a mechanism that we could start to put in place that would say, let's make sure that these become market rate units? And if we were to set up a program so that every 15 years or every 7.5 years, that we have this rolling model whereby you use public housing and those mechanisms to build housing, and then at the 15-year mark it can become market rate housing, we might have a way then to develop the second ward, much of the second ward, so that it becomes a true mixed income and mixed demographic community.
A lot of people are complaining about the density of it. They think that it's too urban a density for us to have this many housing units on a single block. You're an urban designer. Is density necessarily bad?
We need density. Density is good. That's what allows us to walk. This project doesn't come anywhere close to taxing the physical urban environment and or the social urban environment. The real problem is when you build, how tall is Bliss? Is it 9 stories? I can never remember.
I think you're right.
It seems way taller because everything around is low. But there's a problem when you simply pile up people in an object building, that freestanding building, and everyone's in it is low income, and you've isolated them from the social fabric of the rest of the neighborhood. That's a real problem. But if you build density that's close to the ground, 3 stories, 4 stories, people can see from their windows who's on the street below. That builds a communal familiarity that is very good. Density is very good for that.
Is the process by which we have gone about developing this particular parcel problematic?
And what part of the process are you thinking of here? The answer is yes.
So let's break that down. There was an RFQ sent out to developers to sort of gauge interest. And one of the requirements was that any developer have experience with a RAD conversion. You had brought up in one of the meetings that I had also attended that this severely limited the response that we were going to get.
Yeah, RAD is a new program. I don't know, but you said Obama era, and I think it was the second term Obama, if I'm not mistaken. And there haven't been a whole lot of projects, new projects built under it. So I don't think many developers, it's probably a 1 in 10, have experience with it. So you know, we limited the pool, and I can understand why HHA would want someone with RAD experience. But when you limit the pool that much, that means then that those developers that do respond, and we only got 2 responses, are probably not as good in some other things that are also important. So I think we have a developer that's just not practiced in urban design and community engagement and this sort of thing.
I mean, it seems to me that we could have gotten somebody who had RAD conversion experience as a consultant to the project, you know, and gotten the same level of RAD experience, you know, as going to a developer who is just doing this. We limited our options pretty severely.
Yeah, or maybe we could have done it the other way. We could have said, okay, you have RAD experience, we'll go with you, but let's make sure we get an urban design facilitator here, somebody that knows how to work with the community and do the urban design of the project before we get to the actual architectural solution.
So speaking of the urban design of the project, you had brought up some issues that you had, in particular with the renderings as they stand now. What are your big gripes about the process or the project as it stands now?
Well, just looking at the physical design of it, when we first saw drawings, they were only of the new project itself. There were no drawings showing its relationship to anything around it, so not even the buildings across the street. So we don't know some of the basic questions, how some of these questions are being addressed in terms of the basic way that it relates to what's around it. Urban places are places, I mean, I don't want to diminish the human aspect when I say this. They require an organization to the geometry of it. You have to line buildings up until there's a reason to not line them up. That's why Warren Street works. The buildings are lined up, and so you have a path of travel, you have engagement of storefronts and communal engagement with the street. So that building was placed on that site. We don't know how it sits, where how it relates to the other buildings. Does it eclipse the view of the Grange, which is a very nice, important brick building in that corner of the city? How does it relate to the building, the Bliss Tower building, or the other houses across the street? We don't know. The first floor of the two new buildings sits way above the sidewalk for most of the length of that of the new development. So there's not a proper relationship of first floor to sidewalk. That means, again, less familiarity of people inside to what's going on in the street. The massing of the building is very heavy and clumsy. It's meant to reference the Pocketbook Factory several blocks away. I think it should have just been designed for the block that it sits on without that obscure reference to something so far away. And I could go on. We're not looking at drawings right now, so it gets a little bit abstract, but there aren't the sensitivities there that we need.
I want to talk about the HHA meetings that you've been to in general. I know that you and I were at the most recent HHA board meeting, which took place in January, where they voted on PRC as the developer. Before that vote took place, there was a public comment period that didn't last very long. And then the HHA board went into executive session as soon as the full board arrived. Do you feel like the HHA board has been responsive to the community's needs?
Where do I start? I think that, you know, Tim Mattis, the director of HHA, is a very engaging person, and I think he genuinely does want to engage and make people happy. But this is a new process for him too, I'm pretty sure. And so no one on that board, Tim or any of the others, have seen it as their job to get out in front of the community and teach us, educate us on how this works. We are several months into this, and we haven't even seen a basic financial pro forma. That is basically a balance sheet that shows you, here's where we are now, here's how the developer buys in, here's how much money we're spending, here's where we are in year 15 when we have the buyback, here's how much that will cost us, here's how much debt remains on the building. This can be done in a very simple way so that we could follow it line by line by line. But it's just basic things like that they're not doing, and I think it's because they're showing us what they want to do, and I don't want to say they're daring us to stop them. That wouldn't be fair, but it does feel that way. We're not being invited into the process. They have their process that's only theirs, and then we have to interrupt it to try to input it all into it.
One of the things that the HHA board said, and I'm not sure which member had said this, but they had said, you know, if we don't have a RAD conversion, if we don't have a RAD process, it's big enough. If the development project isn't big enough, we're not going to be able to find a developer who just wants to fix Bliss Towers. Mm-hmm. So there has to be this other carrot that is part of the process. It occurred to me as I said this that I don't know if we ever really tried. Do you feel like they have enough expertise in this area to know that it always has to be both and you can't just tease out Bliss Towers?
Yeah, I don't know. It's just not been put in front of us, and even some very rough guesswork as to how those numbers work, put them out in front of us so that we can see. I believe that they are in a difficult financial position, but my fear is that we're basically saying, look, this is going to work for the next 15 years, and we don't know what happens then. So let's just, you know, on a wing and a prayer, do this, and it works now, and then we'll figure it out in 15 years. And that really makes me nervous because we may be in a much worse place.
You know, a lot of projects that I have noticed that there are a lot of disparate parts to the city that don't necessarily seem to talk to each other. Does a project like this fit in with the economic development goals of the city? Does it attract new people? Does it allow more people to live here full time, to diversify our economy?
You didn't mention tourism, and I'm glad you did not, because that too often becomes one of the drivers for new development. How do we attract visitors and tourists? What we want are people who will live here and stay here and invest here and work here and raise their kids here, who will also stay here and raise their kids. So I think it's a question of, are we building a neighborhood or are we just building a building? If you go two blocks would be northwest from the site we're talking about. Kites Nest, which is a terrific local organization, is planning to build a new development for themselves and for Promise Neighborhood, another great organization, on the riverfront. So those are two big projects, the HHA project and Kites Nest, that are about 1,000 feet apart. And I know that neither party has talked to the other, and I've talked to both of them. There is potentially an opportunity to see these two projects as anchors that could lead to the development of State Street, the space in between. And by the way, we could be saying to PRC, all right, since you're on board for HHA, what if we were to develop more of State Street? But in any event, this is an opportunity to make a neighborhood. And neighborhoods mean that the pieces have to talk to each other, so we have to get that going. Kites Nest and HHA should be part of the same conversation, and other people.
One of the things that struck me was that it does seem to be a very myopic sort of silo here. There doesn't seem to be a lot of interaction with other agencies or with other thought to the greater needs of the city of Hudson and Columbia County. It just seems to be, hey, we have to fix Bliss Towers. We have this parcel over here. Let's develop it, and now we have the money to dob. And that seems a bit piecemeal to me.
There is this question of does this new housing answer to the housing study that was done, which called for, 40 new units, I think, and here we have 80. The income mix seems to not match up with what was recommended. And so we have this situation where we are building lower income housing, and that's fine, but how does it work economically? Will we be able to pay for it? The city will not be receiving full property taxes on these new units, so we'll have 73 new units of housing. We'll have to provide 73 housing units worth of services as a result. Plow the streets, provide policing and fire protection.
And lower income and public housing units do have higher tendency towards police calls, towards fire calls. So there is an additional strain.
I don't know, but if that's true, then somebody needs to show us how this works. This project will simply be making a pilot payment to the city, a payment in lieu of taxes to the city, which means a fraction of the typical property taxes that will be paid. So first pass to me says economically or on a revenue basis for the city, it doesn't work. So let's accommodate low-income folks, but let's make sure we look at how this works. And my view is if we can find a way to turn this low-income housing into market-rate housing down the road as we build new low-income housing, then you create a rolling model so that this housing is only temporarily subsidized, and then down the road you have full property tax-paying property owners.
Absolutely. A final question for you. Do you feel like the current process that HHA has undertook to develop this property is going to be serving the population that is already low income in this city?
That's a question that's in the air, and I think Don Moore has done a good job of raising it, and his question may have been misunderstood. There's no one here that is saying we don't want low income folks. We're just saying, how is this going to work? Because if this is to be a Hudson housing project to serve Hudson residents, great. If it's because it's serving Columbia County and beyond, well, again, how are we going to pay for a project that is taking care of the entire county's lower income folks? It just doesn't work.
Matthew Frederick, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, John. Pleasure.
You're listening to WGXE's At Issue. I'm your host, John Kane. Following is a conversation with the head of Hunter Democratic Party, Carolyn Riggs. Because of some technical difficulties with Skype, we are joining that interview in progress. You have recently taken on the task of heading up the Hunter Democrats. What area does that encompass?
So the Hunter Democratic Committee is comprised of the town of Hunter within the boundaries, the town boundaries. So that includes the village of Hunter, the town of Hunter, the village of Tannersville, and the hamlet of Haynes Falls, and I think about two or three of the local parks that are in the Hunter area.
That is, historically, I used to live in Tannersville it's a fairly conservative area.
You know, for a historically resort community, I would say it's been a pretty even split in party affiliation between Republicans, Democrats, and unaffiliateds. We do see a concentration of Democratic voters in Hunter and in the village of Tannersville. But I would say overall, the town of Hunter is a pretty even split in political ideology.
Do you find that Hunter Democrats are a little bit more conservative just in general? I mean, I found in Tannersville, and certainly, you know, in more rural areas in general, that, you know, everyone subscribes to a message of self-sufficiency, whether that is real or imagined.
Yeah, I don't know if I would call it a more conservative Democrat. I would say that we're probably a little bit more moderate than your bigger municipalities, like down in New York City, for example. But we do have we all share progressive values that could be argued are to the left of center.
What are the progressive values that you think are shared between the communities?
You know, I think it's equal rights and, you know, more so healthcare. I'd say universal healthcare, and there's definitely been a push for supporting Medicare for all, or, you know, something like that, that everyone has equal access to affordable and accessible healthcare. But tied with that in rural communities, to making sure everyone has affordable healthcare is also access. And so that's making sure that, you know, our residents, you know, can dial 911 and get emergency services in a timely manner. They have access to hospitals and physicians, physician assistants and nurses in a timely manner. So I think it's more than just, you know, the national, supporting the national policy of Medicare for all, but it's the trend is definitely leaning more towards that type, supporting that type of system. And then also economic development. I think that, you know, we have our resort community here is, you know, starting to thrive again. And not only do we want to support our business owners, but we also want to make sure that we're supporting our employees. So that's making sure that affordable housing and workforce housing is available to our residents and to young people who move up here for seasonal work, and trying to figure out ways that we can get them to stay here year round.
Are second homeowners a big part of the Democratic makeup?
I would say second homeowners are a part of just the general residence makeup. I think there's second homeowners and weekenders in the town of Hunter that cross party lines. I know several Republicans who, you know, come up here for the weekends as well as Democrats. So I wouldn't say it's solely focused on one party over the other. But we do have them. We welcome them. And it's been great to get to know these folks and have them participate in our local politics.
Do second homeowners have priorities that are different from full-time residents that they brought up to you? I mean, there's you know, there are the broader concerns about universal health care and access, but are second homeowners, you know, more focused on making their homes a pleasant place for visitors, whereas full-time residents are really worried about jobs and economic security?
You know, I think the perception is that they wouldn't share, you know, some of the local issues, positions on the local issues, but I find that to be false. I think a lot of second homeowners share the same, you know, concerns about making sure that our businesses stay open and thrive, because they themselves are either, you know, partners in those businesses and or customers of those businesses. And in these small communities, you really build relationships with not just the business owners, but with the employees themselves. And so I think that in talking with some of our second homeowners, they have just as much of a vested interest in making sure that The shop owner and the store manager is, you know, able to make ends meet and to make sure that their kids are enjoying their public education and to make sure that the roads are well maintained and that the bridges are free and clear. So I wouldn't say that, you know, there's specific issues that would divide a full-time resident from a second homeowner, but there's more so issues that they find in common because that second homeowner would not, you know, reap the benefits without the full-time residents here.
So in 2018, Democrats obviously made a pretty strong showing nationwide. They took back the House. Upstate in particular, you know, the CD19 was flipped to a Democrat, Antonio Delgado. Are Democrats seeing that inertia carry over into 2019? Democrats generally are not local issue voters.
Yeah, so what we saw in 2018 was, you know, a big push and support for our Congressman Antonio Delgado. But what we didn't see was that transfer down the ticket to our state level Democrats. And that is definitely a concern for us at the local level as we're coming into 2019, when we have village elections on March 19th. And then we've got town elections and the primary and the general in June and November of this year. So, you know, as a member of the Hunter Democratic Committee, we're looking at engaging not just our Democratic voters, but all voters in making sure that they realize that these small local elections are just important, if not more important, than the national races that we see on even number years.
I think that there's an opportunity for Democrats, certainly probably has been identified in some of these more conservative-leaning, you know, both assembly districts and at the county level, to really make some headway in representation. What are some of the priorities of the Democrats in Greene County as they start to see their numbers increase, you know, and they can finally be a presence that's taken seriously?
Yeah, you know, we're the Democratic committees across Greene County have gotten together a couple times this year, and we're just beginning to kind of formulate, you know, a platform and what issues are important to our residents across the county. I would say more so that our committees are really dedicated at making sure that those who are members of our committees stay engaged, giving them opportunities to make an impact at the local level, and then also engaging, you know, registered voters who may not have been engaged with our Democratic committees in the past. So, you know, you'll see our Democratic committees will be having more socials and having more meetings that are geared more towards the issues that our members have brought up, as opposed to having a more of a top-down approach that has, from my understanding, been how that's done in the past.
How do the Democrats in Greene County make the pitch to Republicans or undecided voters that on the county level, the Democrats would do a better job than the Republicans?
Yeah, that's a great question. I personally struggle with the idea that Democrats or Republicans can do a job better. I think that together they can do a job better. And so really, for us, our main priority, or one of our main priorities, is figuring out a way to bring everyone to the table and see compromise. What we're seeing at the state level is great for Democrats, so to speak, but there's a lot of concern from the Republican and conservative bases that you know, our state government may be going too far and pushing aside too many, you know, small rural communities. And I think that's a great concern for rural Democrats, and we have an opportunity to actually bridge the divide and create relationships with registered voters from that are not affiliated with the Democratic Party, and have real conversations about what solutions and issues are important to us, and then how to implement them, how to advocate for our residents here in these rural communities to the best of our ability. And that includes, you know, engaging our village and our town boards, but that also includes building social power and, you know, approaching the Greene County Legislature and making sure that they are looking out for our best interest as the state continues to move forward.
You know, one of the things, Karl Rove, you know, to many people, he may be the Antichrist, but I think that one of the things that he did really effectively for Republicans was say, okay, we have to build ourselves from a grassroots level and this local community level, and we do that everywhere, and we build out. And he was very successful at creating an apparatus to get that message out. Have Democrats learned a lesson from that?
Yes.
Yeah, have Democrats learned a lesson
from
him?
Yeah, you know, I think there have been many lessons learned, Karl Rove being one of them. Project Red Map, over the last three decades that the Republicans have implemented really was, you know, an impressive movement across the nation at the local and state level. And I think Democrats, you know, in the last few years have realized that to be organized brings power. And so we're seeing a lot more people engaged. We're seeing a lot more organization. We're seeing a lot more coordination with, you know, neighboring towns and committees. And we're seeing our county committees really step up and doing good work and bringing the issues that are important to the residents of our communities up to, you know, the headlines, and making sure, and then holding our representatives accountable to making sure that they're fulfilling the promises from the campaigns and making sure that they're doing the good work of the people.
One of the consistent benefits that Republicans have always had over Democrats, conservative evangelical groups in particular, are that churches give you a way to sort of organize and mobilize your base. Right. And Democrats, because they are more just more secular in general, they have not had the same ability. Does social media level the playing field?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure if this will answer your question, but I think what you're trying to get at is that there seems to be, you know, a common vision and common goals in the church communities. And they've done an amazing job in building that social support.
Yes.
And thus have been able to create political will, as I say it. And I think that Democrats have, you know, when I came into the Democratic Party, you know, I was told, you know, we're the big tent party. And I think it's important that we are, you know, we include everyone at the table. But I also, you know, err on a side of caution with the phrase, when you try and be everything to everyone, you wind up being nothing to no one. And I think that that's something that I personally lead with, that kind of thinking, and making sure that everyone is, you know, included, that inclusion is a part of who we are as a Democratic Party. But we also need to make sure that when we are developing our platform, when we are recruiting candidates, and when we work to support our candidates, that we are as focused as we can be on specific issues, you know, that are prioritized, so to speak, to make sure that we can actually be effective in supporting the initiatives that we want to support.
Hunter in particular has been really dependent on tourism as a driver of its economy for many years. There are the county and state jobs, and there is tourism. How can the Democrats help diversify an economy away, or are the Democrats saying, hey, Hunter is a resort town, we are a resort area? Does it feel the same need to diversify its economy that, say, Hudson does?
You know, I think there's always going to be, you know, opportunities for us to diversify our economy. I think it's important to make sure that we support you know, the existing economic drivers that exist here. Hunter Mountain is, of course, a major driver for that. But our hospitality industry, you know, feeds off of that. So having hotels and restaurants and bars be successful in our communities You know, that provides, you know, a lot of employment and good paying employment for a lot of people who live here. And then, you know, we've got our general, you know, our general stores, and then, you know, just regular retail stores that thrive from that as well. So I think that there is opportunity for us to look at other opportunities. I know that the town board of Hunter has been looking at some developing a master plan, and has included a lot of key stakeholders in the community into that conversation. And that's an ongoing piece of work that they will continue to unfold and troubleshoot and, you know, pick apart and then put back together. And I think that our communities up here and our local elected leaders are doing a really good job at making sure that our communities are taken care of to the best of their ability.
The state legislature, which provides a lot of the funding for our upstate rural counties, a lot of money flows from them to us, has been controlled by Democrats in some way, shape, or form since what is to me time immemorial. Green County and Hunter have not had Democratic representation in the state assembly. Is there a benefit to having Democrats move into the state assembly?
That's correct. I think there's tremendous benefit in having Democratic representation at the state level in the assembly and the Senate, and both of which Green County does not have at this time. And so I think we'll consistently, you know, be looking for opportunities to create that. However, in the meantime, I think it's important that we engage our Republican representatives and encourage them to work with the majority caucuses to make sure that we are receiving funding that is necessary to us sustaining our roads, our bridges, our infrastructure, and really supporting programs that are doing good work here, including tackling the opioid epidemic, making sure that our schools are well funded, making sure that healthcare is, you know, emergency medicine is accessible to all here. So I think there's opportunity for us, you know, to engage our currently seated elected representatives. But, you know, as Democrats, I think we would always think it's important to try and make sure that we present, you know, someone on election years that would give our residents and voters a choice to represent them in the state.
That is Carolyn Riggs. If you would like to see Carolyn or learn more about the Hunter Dems, there is a social meet and greet happening Wednesday, February 13th at Villa Vasilla from 6 to 8 p.m. Carolyn, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me. Have a great day.
You've been listening to At Issue on WGXC 90.7 Acre. You can hear us during the 6 o'clock hour, the first and third Thursdays of every month, as well as 4 a.m. every first and third Thursday for you early birds. Additionally, you can listen to our segments on the web anytime by visiting our website at www.thewavefarm.org/WGXC.
WGXC, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, 90.7 FM, listener-supported radio for open ears. So what we got here, coming up next weekend, the Hudson Jazz Festival, happening on Valentine's weekend, February 15th through the 17th at Hudson Hall at the historic Hudson Opera House, located at 327 Warren Street in Hudson. For information, hudsonhall.org or 518-822-1432. And this all falls under the direction of, and I just lost it, Armin Danilian. He is the one of the cohorts of this group. He is the one of the co-founders of Hudson Jazz Works, along with saxophonist Mark Mamos. So this is all next Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. There are single tickets, and there's also the festival weekend pass that you can have. Again, that's hudsonhall.org or 518-822-1438. And I'm sure if you walk into one of the establishments here in Hudson, you will find a flyer just like the one I'm flapping around here in the studio. On Friday, February 15th, it'll be percussionist Bobby Sanabria and Quartetto H. They start at 7 p.m. On Saturday, February 16th, at 3 p.m., the Solo Piano Summit. Kirk Narok, Lynn Ariel, and Sullivan Fortner. Sullivan Fortner has been touring with vocalist Cecile McLaurin-Salvant. At 5 p.m. that same evening, there'll be a free film screening. From Residency to Legacy, the Modern Jazz Quartet at the Music Inn. And then at 7 p.m., this again is all on Saturday, February 16th, Fearless Masters, Dave Liebman, Jay Anderson, Jay Clayton, and Armin Danilian. And on Sunday, February 17th, at 11 a.m., there is the Free Hudson Jazz Festival Workshop for Youths. And this you need to register for. And at 3 p.m., trumpeter Amir El-Safar with his Two Rivers Ensemble. So there's a lot to be had in Hudson at the Hudson Opera House next weekend. So you go out on Thursday night, which is Valentine's Day, if you have the wherewithal and strength after a day of work. And then on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, take your lovely or lovelies to this festival. Just a suggestion. Lots of things going on in out and about the Hudson Valley of New York, as you know, but here's one of them. So why don't we listen to something from pianist Sullivan Fortner? And you are in tune to WGXC. We heard from two artists who will be performing at next weekend's Hudson Jazz Festival 2019. We're listening to Bobby Sanabria from his release West Side Story Reimagined on Jazz Heads. We're listening to Gym Scene, Blues Mambo. And before that, we heard from pianist Sullivan Fortner from his release of last year, Moments Preserved on Impulse Record, and we heard Pep Talk.
Here's new music from C. Lavender, Assimilation Incineration, from the release Serpentine Fever Dream out in 2017.